And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
I turn them all down because of my voice.
I'm used to shouting in front of a classroom, but I think I'm quieter because of the mic, maybe.
You'll find your path. So thanks for listening to that long story.
Yeah. What an amazing. And you're doing it again.
We're doing it April 6th.
I was just at the center, the one that they do the plays.
Yeah.
I just saw Shrek the Musical.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a cool spot.
Yeah, it's a great. Yeah. It looks like it was a barn.
Yeah, I think it was a barn, mm-hmm. and we toured it, and they have like a dressing room. They have like green rooms, and I'm like, these people don't deserve green rooms. But so what's so funny is I still can't tell that story without crying.
Oh,
isn't that weird?
But it was not that long ago. It sounds like
it was. Like a year and a half, 2 years ago? That's normal?
Recent. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like such a traumatic experience for both of you, right?
Yeah,
and where is she now in her trajectory?
Oh, she's fine. Like, she's homesick today, but it's a cold. She broke her ankle on an exercise bike in the summer, and she called it cute. Because it's
adorable.
Yeah, exactly. That was the other word she used. Yeah. It's just adorable compared to what she went through. So, where are you from?
I'm from Montclair, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. All right. So grew up in Montclair.
Mm-hmm.
And college was?
Wesleyan in Connecticut.
Okay. How was growing up in Jersey? Good, bad,
ugly? It was wonderful because Montclair, I feel like, has a unique spirit to it. Am I loud enough?
No, you're fine. You're doing fine.
My parents moved there because it wasn't sort of, compared to a lot of the other towns in northern Jersey, was very diverse.
Okay.
Socioeconomically, ethnically, and I grew up Jewish as well, and they joined a Reconstructionist temple in Montclair that's still thriving.
Cool.
The school system, I went to the public schools, and it was a so-called magnet school system, so it was meant to also enhance diversity in terms of not just sort of having a school plunked down and having that neighborhood surrounding it be who goes to the school. People were sort of bussed in from different areas.
And
and I loved it. I loved the school. I had a lot of friends. I did theater. I was kind of a nerd. I did well in school.
Did theater acting?
Yeah. Theater,
oh, yeah?
Musicals and things like that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
You sing?
I peaked in high school.
It's a good thing you didn't tell me that before the show, or I would have brought a guitar and asked you.
I love music, though. Yeah.
So no trauma. I'm trying to figure out where the trauma started, because all psychologists have trauma that they're trying to solve, right?
My family was a bit chaotic. I have a twin brother, and I have a sister who's a year and change younger, and there were some rocky periods in our early life, I would say, and I was always very attuned. Because we're all basically the same age. There's a lot of people to kind of keep track of.
Right.
So I think that inspired my interest in psychology.
Is that microphone bothering you? You can just smack it away from you if you want.
It feels a little.
Yeah, I was like, it looks like it's assaulting you.
Yeah. I'm in Poughkeepsie. My sister's in New Jersey. And we get to spend a lot of time together. So.
College.
Mm-hmm.
But theater.
I always loved theater, and I always loved movies and TV. So the arts were sort of a big presence. I learned to play the piano when I was young.
Oh, you know how to play piano, too.
I played till I was...
The next time you're in here, lady, we are going.
I wish... I have to go back to it. I stopped playing when I was about 16, and I kind of choked at a performance and then just was like, I'm done. But I got to a pretty high level of classical piano, mostly faking it using my ear rather than really learning music theory and how to count it out. And So, and now I can do like Broadway fake books, you know, with the chords and the, but not, you know, just enough for my own amusement.
You ever write?
Write music?
Yeah.
No, no.
Oh, I have this theory about, I have a theory about music theory.
Yeah.
That it constricts composition because you learn like.
Rules.
To resolve a chord and blah, blah, blah. And so that's what you think you always do. And once you have rules, everything becomes formulaic and so on. So my point is, you're faking it might be more artistic than actually knowing every single rule. And
I did take one follow-up adult lesson. My dad takes jazz piano up here, and I took one lesson, and the instructor said, okay, play me your favorite song or something. And I played something for him. And he was like, that's very nice. That's not what's written on the page.
Okay.
And so I guess I got the tempo, whatever I did. Right. So I was like, so yeah, I'm not good with the rules for sure. And I remember I did The Wiz, the musical The Wiz in high school. And they brought, because we're so close to New York City, they were able to bring really talented musicians and dancers in to kind of help us with the show. And I remember that when we were auditioning, none of the pianist wasn't using any music. It was all just ear, like no sheet music for the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that.
Do you, all right. So then, but the theater fell off because you got interested in psychology?
It never really fell. I'm still kind of obsessed with theater. I see a lot of theater, but I knew kind of growing up, all you really know about psychology is the clinical side.
Right.
So being a clinician. And so I went to college with a very specific notion of I'm going to be a psychology major. But at Wesleyan, the curriculum wasn't so much focused on clinical as it was on social psych and developmental and cognitive. And so I fell in with, I loved my social psychology class. I don't know how familiar you are with these disciplinary nuances. So clinical psych focuses on kind of the individual,
right.
Even in the aggregate, you know, people who have these types of problems and treatments.
Right.
Social psychology really came out of thinking about groups and thinking about people en masse, but also from a psychological perspective.
Right.
So it's not sociology. It's so the individual in social psychology is an average individual,
okay.
Which is not super meaningful in and of itself because we're all, you know, but it's the kind of the power of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So the classic experiment, Milgram's shock experiment, is sort of a classic now, you know, the ethics have been revised since that day. But
is that where I would shock you?
You'd be told to shock somebody in another room,
right.
Who said, get me out of here. And the question is, how many people would go to the end of the shock generator where it says XXX dangerous because somebody in authority told them to continue.
Right.
So it's trying to understand World War II and kind of like the banality of evil idea.
Is the result of that just an alarmingly high number of people are willing to go to the...
Right. If you asked people to estimate ahead of time, how many people do you think would do this versus what actually happened when you put people in that situation,
right.
It was about 2/3 of the people went all the way to the
really?
End. Yeah. And it wasn't a callousness. You know, that's one of the take homes is that people were quite anxious about it. They were checking. They were asking, you know, questions. Should I really do this? Is it really okay? And so it's a little bit about diffusion of responsibility and
right.
response to obedience. But that's one of the classics that people kind of take with them. But you can tell the story two different ways. You can say, look at the power of the situation that was operating on that person that compelled them to keep going. But you can also ask questions about, well, who didn't go all the way to the end,
mm-hmm.
right? You can think of it from an individual difference perspective. So
that's part of why I asked you to come on
mm-hmm.
here. You're talking about the media and social media, and you're I'm sure you're not alone, although maybe you are.
Hmm.
You're the first psychologist that I've seen take a look at it from the perspective of, because everybody studies like social media, mass media, says do video games make us more violent?
Mm-hmm.
You know, look what social media is doing to us.
Mm-hmm.
But you're the first person I've ever heard ask the question, well, what it's doing to us is in part dependent upon what we're bringing to it.
Exactly. Absolutely.
But
yeah.
But that's that would be to me at least half the equation. Why isn't why isn't this in the lead? This should be the lead question.
Yeah, I mean the basic kind of principle that I tell my students about social psychology is a little bit of a reconciling of kind of the personality social psychology. You know, everything is a situation, everything is a personality. And of course, neither of those is true, right?
Right.
The most kind of reasonable assumption, and it's held up in research, is that everything is a person by situation.
Right.
So even if you have a temperament that leads you in a particular direction, which we do, and even if those temperaments select certain situations over others, there's still an interaction, right? But even the folk, I actually taught at Michigan with the folk, a lot of the media violence folk,
okay.
And they also think about it from an individual difference perspective. And so, just as you said, it's half the equation often. You know, what you bring to the media table informs how you're consuming, why you're consuming, and then it flips back to what kind of an impact it might have.
What's one thing you would change about social media if you could? You're Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh, dear.
What's one thing that you do different?
Well, just to continue the theme that we've just been talking about, that's an example where you said, why don't I see any of this in the way we talk about this publicly?
Right.
The public discourse about either media violence or social media does tend to be very oversimplified.
Right.
And it tends to be, oh, we're all going to hell in a handbasket, or we're all being sucked into this terrible addictive machine. That's mostly what's happening, right?
Right.
Versus, hold, you know, oh, nothing is affecting us in this terrible way. We're all totally fine, you know. So, but it's in between. So, there's no one size fits all in terms of the impact of social media. And in fact, you know, studies that review the now vast amount of literature on social media and well-being, often, you know, the results of those studies are very subtle. They sometimes are, you know, sometimes there's no significant relationship. Sometimes there's a small positive, small negative. And often the studies that show the most negative effects are the ones that get very concrete and specific. So are you somebody who has anxiety about your body image and you're consuming a lot of idealized images on Instagram or TikTok?
Mm-hmm.
You're comparing yourself to other people in those spaces. And then it's kind of feeding back into your own anxieties. So there's a kind of exacerbation that goes on. But yeah, that didn't answer your question, but that's just more context.
That's an interesting twist, though. I was talking about this the other day, too, how, like, because I read some of your body image stuff. And like, one would think that self-preservation instinct would kick in. And I would say, hey, I don't like the way I look. So I'm not going to look at stuff that shows how people look. But it's, in fact, the opposite. It's you're more drawn to it. Why?
Yeah. There's two reasons, I think, at least. So one is that you're ostensibly trying to calm yourself, right? You're looking for valuable information about how does one look to be valued? How should I look to be admired? What is the correct way to look, right? What are the norms?
Oh, okay.
So you're seeking, in a way, you're seeking information to kind of keep yourself where you want to be, theoretically. And
don't you kind of know that, though?
Don't you know what?
Don't you kind of know what you should look like? Because if I don't like the way I look, it's because I know that I don't look like you. So I kind of already know that, right?
I guess so. But the social stage, the social comparison landscape seems to be playing out much more these days online than in real life.
Right.
It happens in real life, too. But that's sort of where people go for social comparison information
right
now. And there's like a limitless supply.
Yeah.
And there's also, I mean, one of the things we're kind of evolutionarily wired to do is to look for helpful social models, right?
Mm.
So who's getting rewarded for the way they look? Who's
right
getting reinforced? And these are the people making millions of dollars on, you know, social media and or celebrities. So I think the motive can be very pragmatic almost of like, how do I look to the kind of most ideal standard
right
and measure. But the other piece of it that can keep people going, I think, is a kind of fantasy where you're engaging with images that you're imaginatively projecting yourself onto.
Oh, okay.
So there's, it's not pure masochism of like, right. Ah, okay. There's a kind of, ooh, maybe I, if I bought those boots, maybe I could look like that. Or mm-hmm. if I had that hairstyle, or this kind of aspirational fantasy where you're identifying with these people. And then maybe only ultimately at the end of the day, you know, when you're sort of back in your own head and space, does it feel crappy?
It's funny too, because like I'm reading your stuff and I'm thinking, so this drive we have, you know, isn't new to us, because like you look at Renaissance statues and everybody's ripped, right? I mean, it seems to be that seems to be pretty much. It's been a long time that we've been doing been doing that. And I didn't think about it until I started looking at your stuff. And I'm like, well, wait a second. She's kind of onto something here, because, you know, Michelangelo's pretty ripped.
And, of course, beauty standards change over time and they change over cultures. There's some similarities that people have identified. But one of the primary ways we engage with each other tends to be visual, right? And so... and in our current landscape, I think more so than maybe other times in history, although it's debatable, our value is so bound up in how we appear to other people. Mm. And I think that's where the social media can get really toxic because of, I mean, there's also the political landscape of, you know, but, you know, young people looking to these image-based and video-based forms of media to sort of make sense of themselves is part of a larger challenge.
And we've had red flags out about that for a while. Are they working at all?
That's also fascinating about human beings, is we can intellectually appreciate something as true and profound, and we can
still eat a Big Mac.
And still eat a donut. Eat a Big Mac. Exactly. I've noticed that over the years, because I started working, it's not my only area, but I started working in eating disorders research right after college in the late 90s.
Right.
And, you know, it was a big deal then. And then I keep thinking, we'll move beyond, you know, however many years later. But my students are still concerned, you know, with their bodies and with their appearance. And it's sadly ongoing, and they're very aware, you know, they're aware of how toxic social media can be. They're aware of the problems of trying to aspire to unrealistic standards, but it's still kind of the water they're swimming in.
Yeah.
So to say none of this matters to a young person, and even to an older person, to say none of this matters, find your identity and character from within is a little facetious, you know. It's a little bit, it's not very persuasive, because they see evidence to the contrary everywhere. They see people being rewarded for their appearance everywhere.
Knowing as much about this as you do, are you still impacted by it?
I am. I like to pretend I'm not, for my students' sake, and I certainly relish the opportunity to look like a frumpy professor. I kind of love that my job is to not look like I put a lot of time and attention into my appearance, for better or worse. But
I don't know about that. You have a nice headshot.
Oh, thank you. That was years ago, too. That's an outdated nice headshot.
That's the way to do it.
That's the way to, it was like 10 years ago. But I do, of course, like anybody, and like a middle-aged female in particular, there's so much, you know, that you're managing and battling, but you're doing it. I mean, the nice thing too is that you're doing it with your peers, you know, and if you're kind of commiserating with people who are actually reasonable targets for social comparison, your own peer group in real life, who everybody's struggling with getting older and what kind of expectations they might be, you know, managing on the outside. And so I try, but of course I'm not immune by any circumstance.
Middle-aged females are tough.
Yeah.
I'm married to one.
Uh-huh. So, we're fabulous.
Very, very, very fabulous.
Yeah.
But so she doesn't listen to the show very much, because I get it. I mean, you live with me. There's enough, John. So she doesn't listen to the show very much. So, but we're talking, and she's perimenopausal, right?
Yeah.
So one day, like 2 months ago, we're driving, and she's like, I want to listen to a show. I'm like, okay, great, wow, how flattering.
How often does it come out? Is it once?
It's two or three a week.
Two or three a week. Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of my full time job now. So
that's amazing.
I got very lucky, and so she flips. Awesome. She picks a show, and it you know, it's on for like 30 seconds, and all of a sudden, I forget even who I had on, but she was talking about being perimenopausal. And I'm like, oh my God, Trish is perimenopausal too. And all of a sudden I get, what the fuck? And yeah, that ended the listening to the show.
Wait, it wasn't a validation?
No. She's like, why are you telling everybody that I'm perimenopausal?
Oh, that you had said about her on the show. Yeah. I see. Yeah. I hear a lot about, I'm very interested in comedy too, and I hear a lot of comedians wrestling with how much they should bring their personal life to the stage and how they navigate that. Yeah.
Well, so I told you before I was crazy. Like, I was crazy. I was underwear, BB guns, shooting aliens, crazy. And part of the way that I cleaned all that up was just to be, like, really public-facing about it. Mm-hmm. And not, you know, and kind of have, like, no boundaries at all, for better or worse. And I think it falls into your field of study. It depends on who you are.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it keeps... Like, I'm pretty regimented about how I manage my head. I think it's chronic. I have it every single day, but I manage it every single day, mm-hmm. and I just make good decisions that day, mm-hmm. and then wake up tomorrow, 3 o'clock in the morning, write 3 pages, meditate for 20 minutes, work out for 2 hours, make good decisions, and then I won't have, you know, and I just do that pretty much every day. That's how I manage it.
Yeah.
So for me, being public facing.
Helps provide a structure for all of that.
And it keeps me accountable,
because
mm-hmm. now I have a following. So now if I, mm-hmm. you know, if I don't work out tomorrow, and I post a lot about it, mm-hmm. so now if I don't work out tomorrow, like, it's part of my, like, I'm accountable, and I need that.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody who's probably more self-directed can be more private about stuff and not.
Well, what you're describing is you have figured out how to successfully regulate yourself.
Yes.
And that's great. I mean,
I don't know about successfully, but regularly.
Yeah, no, but whatever works. I have to give a shout out to a friend of mine who I was just visiting with in San Francisco, who had a great metaphor for how to manage various issues every day and kind of the struggle of everyday life when you have emotional vulnerabilities. And she said she thinks about Quantum Leap. Do you remember this show?
Sure, yeah.
And the idea that sort of you wake up every morning just sort of, okay, what am I today? How do I make a success out of this day given what I've got in front of me?
I love your friend.
Wendy Spiro. Shout out to Wendy.
Hey, Wendy Spiro, you do the podcast?
She has to do a podcast. Yes, we have to get her into the podcast world. Yeah.
Oh, terrific.
You would love chatting with her. She's
I'll have her on.
Also a psych nerd from Wesleyan. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I would love to have her on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what it is. You wake up every day and it's just that day. It's like, because I got misdiagnosed like 35 times and was on like, and then
how old were you when all
50?
Okay.
I'm 61 now.
Okay.
I got arrested and was facing 350 years in jail. I'm here, so it worked out. But when you're facing 350 years in jail, that's a thing. And when I was in the system, I kept getting misdiagnosed. And of course, the jail psychiatrist isn't talking to the probation psychiatrist, isn't talking to the psychiatrist they're asking me to see on the outside, isn't talking to any of that.
Yeah.
So I'm on 7 different medications for 7 different things. One of them is lithium. It turns out I'm lithium toxic. So listener, you can fast forward for a minute. You've heard this already. So I would say like the drug that I was taking so I didn't kill myself was killing me. And I could feel it, but like try.
That's usually for bipolar, I think, right? Lithium?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was one of the many.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like killing me. But try telling that to the world. They're like, yeah, of course you don't want to take the drugs. You're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just like, forget it. I'm going cold turkey off of all 7. I went through withdrawal for like 2 months. It was horrible. And my whole world left. Like, everybody's like, I don't want to be around for this. So even my wife, she came to visit me every day, but even she moved out and was like, but my daughter stayed with me. She was 7 and she got me through it.
Wow.
But I was suicidal. The plan was I was going to clean myself up over that summer
And without then, any help? Without any outside, professional help?
Just me doing it.
Wow.
And then at the end of the summer, my daughter was going to go back to school, and I was going to commit suicide. But I didn't want to do it while I was under the influence of drugs, because then I'd that might be a mistake. Like, am I making a mistake? So I'll get off these drugs, and then I'll see where we stand. But the plan was, I'm going to take my own life when my daughter goes back to school, so that she has a network. Because I'm still facing them like 350 years, and you don't want to bring, you know, who wants to bring that to the people that you love. So it was the day before I was going to do it, and I go down. We live by this lake. It's the day before I'm going to do it, and I go down to this lake, and I don't know. It wasn't me. I don't know who it was. Said, John, if you do this, the lesson you're going to give your daughter is, no matter how hard she works at something, it's going to fail, because she's the one that really worked at cleaning you up.
Mm.
So I'm like, crap, okay, now I have to live. Mm. So then I developed this regimen of 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 pages, 20 minutes meditation, 2 hours of working out, and then just make good decisions that day.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's an amazing story.
It's, you know, it was a crazy time. But another question, and then we'll get back to your work. But
yeah.
Another question: where do you stand on the use of the word crazy?
I heard this in your interview with Wes. Actually,
good.
He had such great answers, by the way, for everything. I'll try not to copy you, Wes. I mean, I'm sensitive to it. I use it in my kind of more casual private life, in a sort of to try to be funny or irreverent, I suppose. And I heard your rationale made a lot of sense to me about owning it and facing it. And I mean, words are so fascinating, and they ebb and flow in terms of their potency and in terms of how they, you know, the students respond to various things. Mm. And I know with Vassar students a few years ago, there was a lot of policing of language around trans individuals, and like the right way to talk about it, and how, what does it mean if you misgender somebody, and how horrible, and this and that. And I feel like we're in a much better space where people are, because time has passed and we've all been educated a bit, we're in a more holistic space where it's not presumed that you're being malicious if you misgender someone. Mm. And things have kind of relaxed a little bit on that end, just the rules about language don't seem to be as salient as they were when it was sort of first coming up as a major identity issue.
Did you have to change the way you teach during that period?
Some people would go around and ask all the students to sort of offer pronouns, was a big trend, and people still do that. And some students will just volunteer it. I never felt quite easy for me to do. I think I did it for a little bit, and again, it's somewhat calmed down, but because making somebody assert a pronoun can also be a way to make somebody uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
So there can be somebody who's not sure or doesn't want to think of themselves in gender identity terms.
Right.
So I thought there had to be space for that too. I've had students ascribe she, her to me, which is technically accurate, I guess, but I don't like to foreground that. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, I don't like to have that as like part of my official identity.
Right.
She, her. It's just not, doesn't mean,
right.
It's not meaningful to me to do that. So.
Do they make you put that on your email?
Some people have it. They do not make you do it.
Okay,
no, thankfully.
Right.
Yeah, they don't make you do it. But I remember, recently I had a student sort of impose a she, her on me in some form they were filling out. And I was like, what? So, yeah. But language, to go back to the crazy issue, language seems like it. And my mom was a sociolinguist by training. So I was very sensitive to language and gender growing up. And you know, the generic he being problematic, and but I think words take on different meanings depending on the audience, depending on who's using them, and this comes up in comedy all the time,
right.
But I appreciated your take on it, and I appreciated Wes. I also had the impression that he should run for office.
Yep.
And then you said it. I was like, yes, that's what I was thinking.
It's enough.
Mayor, maybe.
Right,
start with mayor.
Something.
town council. Yeah.
He's had secret podcast training too. He's too good.
He's so good. Yeah, I was just in a leadership training program that he was part of at Vassar, and he's so great. Yeah. Something about him, his, yeah. But I agreed with you anyway.
Who's your favorite comedian?
I got started in, besides loving SNL and loving Steve Martin and Martin Short and all those guys growing up, I got into comedy again when I was in my 30s. Somebody introduced me to Mike Birbiglia's comedy, and I went to see him a bunch of times and got super into that style. And I like Tig Notaro, and I like, so many people. I listen to the Dana Carvey David Spade podcast all the time. Conan, and it's a lot of middle-aged white guys, I guess, for some reason.
But,
I love Julia Louis-Dreyfus, too. Yeah.
She's funny. Do you you listen to Smartless?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Smartless, yeah. Tig, more middle-aged white guys.
Yeah, right, more middle-aged white guys, true. Yeah. Tig Notaro just did the new one.
I saw that, but I haven't listened yet.
She's hilarious.
She's so funny.
I didn't like her until that. I didn't get it. And then she was on the podcast. I'm like, oh, wow, you're funny.
Okay. We saw her at the Bardavan a year or two ago. My husband and I went to see her. Yeah, she's so great. Her pacing is so funny.
Yeah.
The pausing, right? Yeah. She does these amazing pauses.
She tells a story. You're going to listen to it, right?
Yes.
Okay, I won't run it down.
I've heard a lot of her stuff. If it's the story about...
She's at the party?
She has a few funny party stories, but there's one where she... Well, remind me who it's the person who was in Heart. She has a whole story about one of the singers in Heart. But then she has something about playing...
Oh, Taylor Dane.
Taylor Dane. Yes. She has her Taylor Dane story.
Taylor Dane. She told that one.
Yeah.
And then she told one where she's at a party, and it's like a big party.
She starts playing the piano or something?
No, she doesn't know anybody at the party, and nobody knows her. So she goes into one room, and she just tells everybody, hey, just so you know, I'm going to bed in like 10 minutes. And then she's with a comedian friend. So it was a yard party, and she didn't even know that. So he's like, there's 200 people out in the yard. You have to go. You have to go say that to her. So she goes and stands on the balcony and just says, hey, excuse me, just so everybody knows, I'm going to bed in like 10 minutes.
And it wasn't her house?
No.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I love it. I thought that was hilarious.
She's wonderful, yeah.
How long are you married?
Not that long, actually. This is my I had a brief marriage in my early 30s in Ann Arbor, and just got married 2 years ago.
Wow!
Yeah.
Oh,
2022.
So the shine is still on.
The shine is on. Yeah. Better late than never.
Definitely. So you
stuck
like
the
it.
Landing? Yeah.
I always think it's, although I'm getting that you're not a typical psychologist. Because I can usually figure out, like, from a psychologist what the trauma was and how you're compensating and blah, blah. You seem pretty well adjusted.
I've had a lot of time to get well adjusted. You wouldn't have said that when I was 25, probably.
No?
Yeah, I feel like the 40s, late 40s are kind of a sweet spot for, like, figuring your, stabilizing. But I was almost an English double major. As I said, I love theater and art, so I have that whole side.
Right. What's the trick to your marriage? And is your husband on social media?
No, which is kind of one of the things I like about him. I post about him sometimes because I am, but he's not. He's much more, he's sort of more introverted and... not into the social media thing, but he's also a psychologist.
Oh, really?
He teaches at New Paltz.
Oh,
yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, man. So we have a common...
that's at least the level playing field.
Well, he studies play. There you go.
Level
playing field. Yeah, so we can speak the same language. We're both in academia.
And you can tell when you're doing it on each other.
Yeah, although he was trained in IO. Like, neither one of us was formally trained in clinical.
Right.
I'm more annoying about that than he is in terms of trying to interpret things, but you just marry somebody that you genuinely like and have a good time with.
That's good.
And then if you have an organic connection, then all the other stuff, what do I know, all the other stuff is manageable.
You don't know it, we're in trouble.
We're all faking it, but yeah.
Well, that's possible too.
Yeah.
So back to the media thing.
Yeah.
Is there any heft to the theory that we've had like these basic – part of our attraction is we've had like these basic mythologies for forever, and our attraction to media is manipulated by this like almost DNA. Like I think about the Greek gods and I think about the Marvel movies.
And
I'm like, wait, is that just baked in that we just need these aspirational figures and we need that story and we need.
Yeah. I mean, you're also talking about religion, right?
Which is next up.
Yeah. I think that, yeah, one of the ways that I make sense of media or media psychology as a subfield comes out of social psychology, which comes out of just basic human needs and tendencies. Mm-hmm. So you've probably seen this other places, but the idea that, you know, we have a need to belong and a need to be seen in a positive way by our peers. I mean, this is coming out of theorizing from, you know, the late 1800s and earlier, you know, that we have a kind of we are social creatures. So a lot of what you see happening on social media arguably is capitalizing on existing very primitive needs to be affiliating and to be demonstrating our own positive qualities to each other. Yeah.
It's funny about being social.
And admiring people, to your point.
Yeah. It's funny about saying we're social creatures because I heard it described like early on, like we're herd animals and we like to live on top of each other and we just like to be around each other. Then COVID happens and we're not. And people start working from home. Then COVID unhappens. Not everybody went rushing back. So then I'm like, are we social people? Like, you know, nobody wanted to go back to the office and still don't. And I know a lot of people that were just like, I was okay with being locked down.
Yeah, that's so true. And some students did much better without kind of constant peer management going on. But I think so that goes back to the individual differences piece too, right? Some people were devastated to be untethered, and some people were not.
Right.
So there's that component of, you know, who finds social life more enervating and stressful and who doesn't. But there's also maybe structural stress built into people's work lives that's not ideal, right? Our system may not be great in terms of how much people relished the opportunity to be at home and and not have to navigate various things in the workplace. Yeah.
So back to what I first said about you. What I love about your work is you're the one asking the question, what is it that John brings to the table?
Yeah.
Forget what Mark Zuckerberg's doing to John. What is John bringing to the table?
Yeah.
So that got me thinking about religion. And you said you were raised Jewish.
Yeah.
Right? Still?
Yeah, I mean I'm not like observant culturally. You know, my grandparents fled Poland in World War II and lost immediate family members who were shot in the street and hauled off. And so my legacy, my mom's a first generation first generation from the Holocaust after, you know, so her parents came here and didn't teach her a word of Polish because they didn't want her to be a target. So I have that particular flavor of Jewish background. But so I feel very connected to the history and the culture and some of the rituals around the holidays. And I'm sending my kid to Hebrew school. He's like, why do I have to go to Hebrew school? You just have to go to Hebrew school. That's what you have to do. But my husband's not Jewish, and I'm an atheist. I'm not.
You are.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which is news to a lot of people who I don't know what your background is, but it's news to a lot of people that you can feel identified as Jewish and not believe in God or even, be remotely observant
because of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That probably helps with your work then, because I'm not atheist, and so when I look at your work, I'm like, okay, it's not only what John brings to the table, but it's whatever the universe is doing with me too at the time.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what's funny is that my social psych professor at Wesleyan, whose name's Scott Plowse, he reminded me of my rabbi growing up because sermons, at least in Reconstructionist Judaism, feel very academic in flavor. There's a lot of, I remember one time that my rabbi looked out and said, like, for those of you who believe in God, da 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 da, right? Or this makes us question this issue. There's a lot of like analysis of, you know, religious texts that happens in Judaism and a lot of wrestling with how do we keep this relevant and what do we not like and what do we like and how can we think about this in a way that applies to our current circumstance. So there was so much social psychology layered into my Jewish upbringing that it felt pretty natural to connect in that way.
Well, it's funny. So I'm an orphan, right? So like a year and a half ago, Christmas before last, my wife gives me Ancestry DNA. And I do it, and I discover a bunch of brothers and sisters who all amazing, like almost to all of them incredible people. So cool. Found out my father was just like the biggest asshole on the planet. He just he impregnated the entire Hudson Valley and then took off.
So you have local siblings found out about.
Yeah. Wow. But so then I go to my this relates to you. So then I go to my wife. Well, if I did it, you have to do it. So she does it. And she's 51 now, so she's got a couple years on you. But she's but same generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And she goes, so she does it and finds out she's 40% Jewish.
Nice.
But because her grandparents came up with same circumstance, they completely abandoned it because they were afraid, and they kept it a secret. And like my wife's mother knew it, but didn't tell any of them, so they never knew that they were until she did Ancestry DNA.
That's fascinating.
And I'm like, your mother's maiden name is Landau. Nobody put two and two together.
That's so funny. And my last name was changed by my dad's father.
Okay.
To avoid. And yeah. I have a cousin who's like, yeah, we're fooling everybody. Used to be Greenstein. Now it's Greenwood. But I think, I think that was a common issue. Yeah. And even when it was on the table to kind of, you know, legacies of loss and anxiety filter in. So
how'd you get to atheism?
I feel like I was my parents were never God people. They were my dad. You know, my dad grew up kosher and hated every minute of it, and so
that
he's
would be
the
biggest pain in the ass. I kind of get that.
Yeah, the over controlled. Yeah. So he goes out and buys bagels on Yom Kippur when you're supposed to be fasting, but or Passover when you're not supposed to be eating bread. And my mom was raised in a kind of secular Jewish space. My grandmother was not, you know, she wasn't bat mitzvah. It was uncommon anyway for girls. But so it never occurred to me that it was a prerequisite, you know?
But you,
my sister does, I think. But
did you ever go through a period of examining it, or have you just always been that way?
I think psychology offers such an easy template to be like, I see why people need this, you know, I get it. It seems so easy to explain the need for religion or the desire for religion from a psychological perspective that I didn't need anything beyond, that tracks, you know, human being. But I get interested in things like you know, simulation theory and multiverse. You know, I like thinking about synergy. And I mean, I don't think you have to believe in God to feel spiritually connected to other people.
No, you don't. That's kind of where I'm struggling. Because what you just said resonated. Like, because you thought, you know, psychology gives you such a great, easy way to understand why people would need religion.
Yeah.
And then my follow up to that is, but that doesn't make them wrong. It just because you need
I
need food, that doesn't mean that wrong, that I'm wrong to eat.
Right. I guess I don't feel the need to wrestle with that kind of thing.
Right.
There's a social psychologist who has his own podcast, and he talks about the psychological benefits of religion and religious belief.
Yeah.
And there are many, right? There's a lot in the best case scenario, you know, connecting to something bigger than yourself, being a part of a community, being part of a community that might have certain values that you really care about.
A moral compass, because some people need that. But then church messes it all up.
Right. It's not a perfect system,
No,
right?
It's really.
It's too much room for interpretation, right? But all of those things are meaningful and valuable. I don't know if you have to figure out if they're right objectively, you know.
So where are you on simulation theory?
Oh, I mean, I was talking to a college friend recently who was a physics major, and I was I was asking him about multiverses, but also simulation theory. I'm not really anywhere. I just thought it was really interesting. Like, I love the very kind of meta perspective on things, maybe not surprisingly. And so the idea that
life is not surprising, right?
The bird's eye, that your life could be put in perspective of, like, you know, or even the old thing of, like, what if we're all just on a butterfly's wing, or what if we're all in a stop motion video, you know, I just like thinking that way because it gives me a different perspective on human beings and on my own life. And so it's almost just sort of mentally amusing and interesting to contemplate, right. You know? What if everything we think we're sitting in isn't what we're sitting in, kind of thing?
Simulation theory, I don't know if I buy.
Right.
But multiverse, I can get by. That just makes math sense to me.
Yeah, but my friend just totally shot through it the other day. Uh-huh. I was really into it. And there's so much out there now about the multiverse with Spider-Man and everything everywhere all at once. And the idea that you can see all the paths not taken so clearly in your mind. Your story alone is an amazing story of like what might have been, right? Mm-hmm. These kind of counterfactual scenarios of if this hadn't happened, if that hadn't happened, if you hadn't taken your wife to that exercise class, all these things. But my friend was like, it's just because people have a hard time with probabilistic reasoning. Like it's just about probability rather than everything has to all be happening, you know?
Yeah, but if the universe is infinite, right?
Yeah.
Then a multiverse has to happen because if the universe is infinite, then there's an infinite number of outcomes that all have to take place because it's infinite. So I don't understand how you can think that the universe is infinite and not believe in a multiverse.
I've had a big discussion. My brother's into this too. I feel like there's the question of why, because you can conceptualize of alternative realities, why it means that they are all happening. The leap between, but there's different ways to think about infinity, right? I mean, it doesn't necessarily require infinite pathways. I don't know. These are the questions. So you can conceptualize different outcomes all you want. Doesn't necessarily follow that they're all occurring, right? That you can imagine them. It's kind of like the religion thing, right?
Unless the universe is infinite. So if the universe is infinite, then every single possible outcome of every single possible thing.
But infinite in what way?
Not bound by anything.
Not bound by
space, time, any of it.
Yeah.
If the universe is really, really infinite, then everything has to happen.
That's the part I can't get from one to the other.
Because there's an infinite. If the universe is infinite, then the circumstances that create the Earth are duplicated, but a little off. And now you're interviewing me instead of the other way.
Yeah,
there's one where Wes is sitting with us, all because there's an infinite number of Earths, except this Earth tilted a little bit this way, and I'm a professor, and you're a dumb podcast host.
No. I think I love the idea.
Right.
There's something very, I think some people find it stressful. I find it very relaxing and interesting to imagine this is just but one version of reality.
I think it's terrifying that there's an infinite number of my ex-girlfriends out there.
Well, choose the reality that feels good to you.
There are no ex-girlfriends out there.
Yeah.
There's a reality of that, so I'll do that.
Yeah.
Close relationships is one of your primary interests. You ever think about being a marriage counselor?
No, I think because I left the clinical path pretty early. I remember when I was graduating, I asked my professor, I said, why can't I go to grad school for clinical and social?
Right.
Why isn't there just a clinical social? And he was like, that's not really how it works. You get trained in a very specific way for clinical that is not the same as social. Mm-hmm. Although there are journals called like the Journal of Social and Clinical Psychology, and they're incredibly overlapping. So you can be a social psychologist studying clinically relevant issues, but you're not necessarily studying clinical populations, right? So you can study anxiety more broadly construed or belonging or attachment anxiety. I've always been interested in clinical phenomena, but maybe not from the counseling perspective.
Right. Well, I just thought it was interesting that a social psychologist would be interested in close relationships.
Yeah, it's a whole sub area. Actually, I got this from my master's and dissertation advisor at UMass, who studied close relationships, and there's whole courses you can teach in close relationships. But again, it goes back to like we are people among people, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can think about the group as the unit, but you can also just think of dyadic relationships, caregiver-child relationships, attachment theory has this wonderful connection between how we engage with our parents and how our caregivers, and then how we engage with romantic partners, having some overlap there.
Yeah. Maybe too much overlap
life is
there.
Difficult. In some cases. I say that attachment styles that helped you survive childhood can become liabilities in adulthood, right? Like the survival strategies that get you out of your own childhood can trip you up, right?
A lesson I learned. Yeah. Very, very, very true. So
I think the migration to media from close relationships is thinking about what everybody seems to now know is parasocial relationships, when you have a particular sense of intimacy with a favorite media figure or character in a story. You bring some of your interpersonal self to those kind of imagined relationships.
Are those relationships imagined?
They're emotionally real to a certain extent, depending again on who you are and what your interests are. But to the extent that we can say that you're forging a connection with someone who is not reciprocating, right? It's not a reciprocated relationship. It's a symbolic relationship that you're forming, which people do with religious icons.
And pets,
yeah.
Yeah.
Pets arguably are there, you know?
Right.
But not to the extent, yeah.
Do you think online friendships are real friendships?
Yeah. I know. You know, I mean, this is a whole other issue that can go in various directions, right? You can forge online friendships that can be nourishing versus toxic, right? But if the alternative is a young kid sitting alone in, you know, high school, sitting alone in their room, feeling, you know, despair and isolation, versus communicating with somebody online and feeling connected to another human and another community, that's definitely in the health direction, right? Yeah.
Can you envision a time where I would take a personality inventory and then my social media or all my media would be brought to me based on my personality inventory instead of having to work through an algorithm? It is kind of an algorithm,
yeah.
But it's a more targeted one than what I would get just based on what I saw before, which is now. Can you envision that? Like, I think that would be more rewarding for me.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, it would depend, right? And I'm sure they're doing this in so many different ways. They get all the quizzes that they get people to take online, you know, which Harry Potter dorm do you belong in and all that. but which Sex in the City character are you?
Yeah. Which one are you?
Oh, my God. Carrie, I guess.
Are you Carrie?
That's like the best one. She's a little bit of everything, right?
Yeah. She's
multidimensional.
A safe pick.
Mm-hmm.
She's a safe pick.
Yeah, she's not as much of a caricature
as
the other one. But I mean, if you had to, it would depend on what aspects of your, I mean, personality as a sort of field is a whole other area, and you can conceptualize personality in a few different ways.
Mm.
Like, what are your needs? What are your vulnerabilities? What are your
responses?
Interests? Yeah. What are your responses? But there's so many different ways to slice that. So, yeah, I don't know.
What's your own take on it?
On social media or
personality?
I like the idea that things get layered up, that you start with a certain kind of temperament when that's sort of genetically, biologically, you know, based, that you're sensitive to loud noises or not, you know, or you're resilient and adaptable, or more sort of vulnerable and less adaptable. And then the experience layers onto that and interacts with that. And it's very complex, right? It goes so many different directions. But the idea, again, that you have some foundational material that you're dealing with.
Right.
And then you have life material, some of which is dumb luck, you know, what circumstances are you born into or not born into, right? And then, yeah.
Which universe you were born into.
Exactly. Which of the many multiverses. Maybe we're in two different ones right now. We're just communicating across.
We're doing
two
a
different
good job,
multiverses.
Though.
Yeah. We're bridging it.
That's part of why, another reason when I was writing about what you do, another reason that I like it, to me, the arc of psychology was it's the study is created, and it wants approval from its big brother medicine, so it follows like a really academic route, and you have to be a doctor to practice it. You
not psychiatry,
no psychology too.
Oh, a PhD.
Yeah,
you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can do. You can.
You don't have to anymore.
Counsel with a master's.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you still, it's school.
Mm-hmm. Credentialed.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. It's credentialed, and although wasn't licensed in New York until like really recent, like in the last 20 years ago, there wasn't licensure in New York
for counseling.
Years. Yeah.
Huh.
Weird, right?
Yeah.
I think New York was like the last state to require licensure. But so that because it's academic, there's schools of psychology mm-hmm. and theories and blah, blah. And then you get this training and you go out and you – if you choose clinical path, mm-hmm. you choose a clinical path. And everybody that walks into your office gets the benefit of the toolkit that you acquired at school.
Mm-hmm.
Except what you just said is really true. Everybody who walks into your office is different from everybody else that walks mm-hmm. into your office mm-hmm. inherently and then what life did to them.
Mm-hmm.
So – it's throwing a dart to see if what's in my toolkit is mm-hmm. going to work with you.
Yeah.
And the odds are it's not. To me, a smarter way to develop a – tell me what you think of this. To me –
Are you talking about teaching somebody in an academic setting or counseling somebody?
Counseling somebody. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody – you know, there's going to be 10 people that walk into my office. I got my PhD from Columbia and I'm a behaviorist and you're getting behaviorism.
Oh. Although, just to – argue with that for a second. I think nowadays, I'm not as plugged into the clinical world, but nowadays I think it's pretty typical to have eclectic as your background and, you know, attuning, you know, some people need a little more cognitive behavioral, some people need a little more
right.
psychodynamic.
Yeah, yeah. But you're not necessarily trained in that. Or if you are, you're so alternative
yeah.
that you can kind of get like a little woo-wooed. But it is trending now.
More now. People come in. And people come into academia as more hybridized.
Right.
So,
like
you're
kind of all over.
I'm a bit of an interdisciplinary creature. Yeah. I'm technically.
That's what I'm going to say tonight when Tracy goes, look, you got to pick one. You can't watch football and play the guitar. And I'm like, I'm interdisciplinary.
I'm multidisciplinary.
There you go.
Yeah. So I think that's true. A lot of people, it's still siloed, to your point, 100%.
Right.
Territories, my theory is better than your theory. My discipline makes more sense than your discipline. My way of knowing is better than your way of knowing.
Like religion.
Yeah. But there's been, I think, in the you know the last 10, 20 years, a much greater appreciation for you know, diversity of thought, you know, being able to braid together social psychology with neuroscience, right? There's a field called social neuroscience.
Thank God, because that was my point.
Yeah.
I think a better way to understand people isn't to look at John. I think it's to look at all the Johns mm-hmm. and see what they all do and use that as my foundation instead of it's your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Like from benefiting from what you do mm-hmm. and saying like, you know, listen – that, say I have general anxiety mm-hmm, disorder. Mm-hmm. What you do is say, listen, you have general anxiety disorder. That's what you're bringing to Facebook.
Yeah.
So let's manage that.
Yeah.
And understand that.
Yeah.
When you're interacting with so or mm-hmm. when you realize that you don't look exactly like Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
Understand that you're bringing that to that. To me, that's mm-hmm. and everybody does that. Mm-hmm. To me, that's much more useful than 14 weeks of, you know, my mom called. I had to buy – this is true. I had to buy Husky pants when I was in, like, third grade. And, you know, mm-hmm. now I work out 2 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
To me, what you're saying is much more practical, mm-hmm. a shorter curve, even for clinical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that sometimes the punchline for some of what I and others do is to think about – how might that apply to a clinical setting?
Yeah.
You should maybe ask a teenager what music they're listening to or why or what are they resonating with online or what are their favorite TV shows? Not
right.
Because there's been so much of a dismissal of entertainment media as kind of bullshit on the side, extraneous, like recreational, whatever.
Right.
And I think now there's much more, because of how ubiquitous media is, there's much more of a like understanding that this is a big piece of many people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so to not address it as meaningful, you're missing out on a whole lot of information about that person.
I have my daughter and she's a senior in high school. I had her and 9 other people from her class in here. And
wow,
it was amazing. It was like 4 hours, and I learned so much. But one of the things we did was took a look at screen time, and I think the average was like 7.5 hours a day.
Yeah.
So
how do they measure? Like, I don't even. This is a technological limitation on my part. But when they do this screen time, is that when you're actively engaging?
I think when it's on. Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question.
You never know what it's it keeping track of, like when you're pressing on something or when you have a window open.
When you're watching something. And people get alarmed by that statistic. Like, you know.
But so texting, if you're texting your friends all day, that's going to eat up a lot of time. Yeah.
Or if you watch a 2.5 hour movie on Netflix.
Right.
Which you would have been doing on your TV.
Or you're
anyway,
listening to music while you're exercising.
Which would be good. Right. That's screen time too. So maybe, maybe it's not as alarming as I thought it was.
It might not be, It might be. I mean, and the research, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, the big reviews are, you know, not surprisingly, there are very nourishing ways to use media. If you're communicating with friends, if you're feeling effective, you're engaging your, you know, political ideals, if you're using media in intentional and meaningful ways, it can be very useful.
Yeah.
And if you're lonely and you're scrolling through this or that and you're watching other people be connected to each other and you're kind of part of it vicariously, but then you realize you're really not. You know, you might end up just as empty on the other end.
So COVID happens, mm-hmm. and my daughter was seventh grade or something. And she had, they go to school on the phone.
That's the hardest hit age, middle schoolers,
But I'm like, thank God for social media, because what she could do is she had a friend and they would just take school together, so she'd have like schools on the computer and her friends on the phone. So it was like she was sitting next to her friend while she's in school, and that made it way less isolating.
Yeah, a lot of the data coming out of COVID is on the positive side of media, of people connecting, and especially. And this is not true in your case, but if you're in a household that's not a very warm or accepting household, and you can reach out through the through the interwebs to find people that are, that's huge for mental health.
Mm-hmm. Do you have kids?
I have one son. Yes.
How old?
He is 8, going on 18.
Oh, you have an 8-year-old.
I have an 8-year-old.
Oh, wow. What's your policy?
Oh God, I'm the worst. I mean, I get to talk about him all the time in class. Yeah. I mean, so I kept him off of screens very hardcore for the first like 3 or 4 years, I would say, and then it slowly crept in. And now it's a little bit, in addition to kind of like you need to take a break, get off your iPad kind of thing, it's a little bit more, what are you watching? Because I understand if I had grown up in this constant stimulation source, it would be hard to generate it, you know?
Right.
But he's pretty well-rounded. If you put him in any engaging situation, he loves it. So he's not like, oh, where's my iPad when he's at summer camp, you know?
Right, okay, cool.
I see that it's a source of stimulation, but for me, it's also just very, like, what are you consuming?
Right.
Got to watch the body image stuff, right?
Yeah.
He already knows about muscles and whatever. Yeah.
I knew about him too. I just didn't have any.
I tell him, like, little boys are not actually supposed to have muscles. Thank God you are not a little boy with muscles. Yeah. That would be weird.
That would be really weird.
Yeah.
What's the biggest surprise that you've had in your research? Something you learned that you did not expect to be true.
That I did not expect. I think I take the easy way out with research in a way, because I keep myself pretty open to, well, I could see how this might be the relationship I find, but I could also see how that might be the relationship I find.
That's probably the right way to approach it.
It's more,
I don't
like
think that's an easy way.
Well, the hardcore researchers are very systematic and mechanistic and study one, study two, study three, and, you know, doing experimental and longitudinal work, which takes so much muscle and brain power. And I tend to do a bit more survey-based studies, like how do these things all go together? Oh, look, this thing. I think...
But you don't bring bias to it.
I try
See,
not
the
to.
The first way that you describe seems to me that there's a bias. Because you do the one experiment.
Yeah.
And you would say, okay, it could go that way, it could go that way. But I'm going to pick another experiment. Well, I'm going to pick that experiment based on the way I think it will go, which is a bias. And then,
well, there's two ways to think about bias. You can be selective in what kinds of questions you ask. So going back to social media, the lion's share of the research is on the ill effects or the problematic associations with mental health and well-being that social media have. So few people, although now more and more, are looking at, well, what about flourishing? What about resilience?
Right.
What about things that we associate with doing well and having, you know, a strong sense of self or positive well-being? So those questions don't get asked the same amount that the other questions do. We tend to focus on the negative. And so there is an imbalance in the sense of what kinds of questions are we asking. But if you're trained well, the bias is not supposed to go beyond that kind of what are you interested in. I mean, there's certainly, you can analyze data in different ways, right? And we could talk forever about, you know, people being unethical with their data. But if you're doing a kind of experiment or a survey, you have to hold to certain standards of scientific methodology, and you have to allow for the possibility that your hypothesis is not going to be supported by the data.
Right.
So you have to, you're supposed to be letting the data speak for itself.
Right.
Even if you go in with preconceived notions, you're supposed to be fallible to your exact point of like, what have you been surprised by?
But, right.
Yeah.
Does it in 4 years, is AI going to take everything you've learned and tip it upside down anyway?
Oh, my gosh, AI. Yeah, we're at the tip of the iceberg with AI. I mean, people are using AI
people
to do...
People say that. I don't know, like...
You don't think we're at the tip of anything? Are we in the bottom?
I don't, no, I like... People say, like, we're at the tip of the iceberg of AI. And it's the same thing as when people say, like, we only use 10% of our brain or whatever.
Yeah, which is not true.
In order to know that, you have to
know how big the iceberg is.
Yeah. Thank you. Finally, I'm talking to somebody that gets me.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I don't know if we're at the tip of the iceberg. Maybe we're done. Maybe AI's accomplished all it's going to accomplish.
I think we're still testing it because, I mean, even with data analysis, people are using AI to write code. I just talked to someone who said they used a former student, said she was working on some project after college, and they were feeding data into AI to see how AI would analyze it. And so I have half a mind to try that. I have some open-ended data that I would be curious how AI could be harnessed to do some qualitative coding and compare that to humans and like, are they getting it? Are they, how many parameters do you need to set?
Right.
So I think we're still trying to figure out the utility. And then you have all the articles about I'm in love with my AI boyfriend, right? That was just in the Times. That comes up like once a month now. There's like a big expose about someone who's in a relationship with an AI.
Yeah. So. I used it to write an ad kit for the show.
Ah.
Holy Christmas, it was so good.
Wow.
I mean, it knew like everything. It knew like everything. Like it knew that I owned 3 Takamine AN10 guitars. It knew that just weird.
Because it's scraping your info.
Yeah.
Wait, what is an ad kit? I don't even know.
Oh,
what, like so how to find advertising.
So we send out a kit that says, you know, we're number one on Mixcloud, we're number two on Spotify, we're blah blah blah, and then you try to, you know, and you get advertisers that way.
Yeah.
And it wrote the whole freaking thing. It
was like a pitch. It writes a pitch.
Yeah. It's like why advertise on Home From Here? It's the most listened to podcast in the Hudson Valley. It's, you know, hey advertisers, if you're listening, it's, you know, it's in a great genre because it's uplifting and it's community based and it wrote the whole thing.
Wow.
It was weird.
Wow.
But then I'm like, okay. In that, if AI is going to be such a prominent part of our life, does that dilute a little bit what you're doing? Because you interact with AI, but you don't, right? Like if I ask AI to write my bio, which I have, and it says, you know, community oriented, funny, whatever it says.
Yeah.
It hasn't learned that by interacting with me, right? So.
Well, your digital footprint.
Digital footprint. Mm-hmm. It interacts with, but that's different than watching a movie. There's nothing AI does that I'm aspiring to. There's no mythology in AI that I. Blah, blah. There's not even pictures yet.
There's art AI, right?
There is art AI.
That's a whole other thing.
I use that all the time, and that's weird, too.
Yeah.
I'll do it for your show. I do like a billboard that says, you know, Home From Here, episode 312, Dr. Darren, blah, blah. And
Wow.
Yeah, but that's a different interaction where what I bring to it.
You're driving the bus a little bit more. Is
less,
that what you're saying?
I'm driving it less
with AI. You're driving it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Because I don't have a choice in, you know, like when I go to pick a movie, I have a choice what I'm going to watch. So what I'm bringing to the experience is what I, you know, AI. I don't have a choice. Now if I'm doing AI as much as I'm doing Netflix during the day, which most people are, that's a different digital media environment. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where what I bring to the table isn't.
But you're doing the inputs, right? You're asking questions.
You're asking, yeah.
You're shaping things. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you're shaping things, though. You're asking questions, but are you.
Like, you know, get me an ad kit that. Da, da, da,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. But that's, you know, I don't tell it I like blue. I mean, it just does that. So.
Well, you have interacted with AI way more than I have.
Yeah.
But. I think I don't know what I don't know at this point about AI.
It's entertaining too.
Yeah, see what it comes up with. I mean, people use it for writing TV shows, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or not the whole show, but like the plots,
right,
you know, like
right.
And the speed. And then, you know, there's concern about what resources is it using and the sustainability piece of it.
Right.
And where is it going to maybe exploit vulnerable people, mm-hmm, to the whole like interpersonal relationship piece of it?
Right.
Is it beneficial? Is it not? I think there's so many questions. I don't know if it'll upend. Maybe I'll just pivot to looking at how people engage with AI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are AI boyfriends at all good for anybody ever?
Sure. I mean, you can't. It's like the whole thing is like anything that's not complicated is probably wrong. Right? So everything is a person by, you know, like, why is somebody, the person who they wrote about in the Times was overseas from her husband. And so she was not without contacts and connections, but she was isolated in that time. And she was very extroverted, but then it seemed like it got a little intense. Like she started wanting to engage with the AI much more. It kind of became more of a, I don't know, somebody might call it like an addiction template, but she started putting more money towards it, paying $200 a month so she could keep going and going and going. So there was a spiraling that seems to happen to her, and that's obviously one case. But you could imagine somebody who dabbles in it to deal with a temporary loneliness or isolation, or somebody who's shy or anxious using it as scaffolding to get kind of practice or courage to be out and about. But then you could also imagine it inhibiting people, right? Mm. Like if your AI boyfriend or girlfriend is so perfect that nobody else is ever going to compete,
right,
then you're kind of wonking out your standards a little bit,
right,
and becoming, yeah.
Is that cheating?
Is it cheating on somebody?
Yeah. Like
this came up in the article too. She told her husband about it. This is in the New York Times.
Oh, so it's a threesome.
And he was like, that's fine. He's like, I watch porn. That's fine.
Yeah.
So it all works out. But I think that she's now feeling guilty about the money she's spending. I think she's not telling him about the money. Now
right.
He knows. He read the New York Times.
Whoops.
Out of the box.
Yeah. Porn's interesting to from your perspective of what do you bring to it.
Yeah. And what's out there? I mean, porn is understudied a bit. It's studied more now, I think, than it used to be. But there's a lot of stigma in psychology and in media studies to study pornography. Mm-hmm. There's like a stigma, right? So
yeah.
It's not many people in that
of
club.
Of course, you're studying porn,
right? Like, what are you doing? And then right. You can do the psychoanalysis, like, oh, look who's studying porn,
right?
but of course, there's you know, multiple dimensions of that. You know, there's very problematic pornography, and then there's feminist sort of positive representations
right.
of sexual behavior on. And then there's questions about whenever you're talking about is this good for you or not, you have to ask, is it interfering in a meaningful way with your life and your job and your relationships? Is it you know, causing you to treat yourself badly or others mm-hmm. badly, right? So to the extent that it's that you're doing well in life and this is sort of a piece of it,
right
as opposed to being maybe consumed or maybe pulled into some really problematic or violent or antisocial images and messages. It's all over the place, right?
Yeah.
It depends.
It's
yeah.
funny. I had a, I was talking to a, I did therapy like a gazillion. It didn't work. It never worked. I had like 8 different therapists. It for some reason, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But I had one therapist say that when you watch porn the first time, maybe it was a minister. When you watch porn the first time, all you want to do is have sex. When you watch porn the second time, you never want to have sex again. and I'm like, for some people, that's probably, like, for me, that's true. But for some people, like, addiction to porn is a yeah. real problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So anything that pulls you into something extreme,
right?
Again, you can go back to like eating donuts or Big right. Macs or whatever. It's such a boring thing to say that like everything in moderation, right? But and then of course moderation for one person isn't for another right. person. Like I have friends who can't keep certain foods in the house because if they have it in the house, they will eat too much of it. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who can regulate, right? I'll just have a little bit at a time, and
right.
Yeah, everybody needs to game their own system a little bit.
I would love to see, like, I think your question of what am I bringing to whatever
mm-hmm.
should be, not to bring it back to clinical, but I think that should be the first question asked.
Yeah.
In almost every, I'm fighting with you. First question I should ask, what am I bringing to
this? This was literally the point of the leadership, how to handle conflict. Like, don't assume that you're not part of it. Don't assume right. you're not part of a larger system, mm-hmm. right?
But it's yeah. a great way of thinking. If, yeah. if your first reflex, whether it's TikTok
yeah.
or your professor husband or yeah. my dumb teenage daughter, it is to say, like, what are you – first question, what am I bringing to it?
Yeah.
What's my part? Like, I wish that was taught.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's hopefully an appreciation at Vassar and in other spaces that there's a holistic take you can have, right? That it's not just everything coming at you or everything going. But even that, you know, like in this leadership thing we were talking about, having personnel problems is really code for like there's something in the dynamic of the group and this and that. And I was sort of like, no, sometimes it's really just a person, you know, they're sort of unanimous. So sometimes, you know, you fall on one side more than the other.
Right.
Sometimes the situation matters more than the person. Sometimes the person matters more. But
yeah. That should be the starting point.
Yes.
Though is what am I bringing here? Because
yeah.
by the way, that's the thing I have the most control over.
Yes.
So
yes, absolutely.
So
it's empowering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Whether it's conflict mm-hmm. resolution or it's career choice
yeah.
or it's whatever. If the first question is the Greenwood question, yeah. what am I bringing to the party?
Yeah.
Then that seems to me to be the smartest place to make decisions from.
And then you can say, what am I doing that's not serving my actual
right.
interests? And there's a lot around trying to be more mindful about media consumption mm-hmm. and intentional about it.
You know where yeah. I use your question all the time? Parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Parenting is a great place because, like, I have a heart attack every time my daughter pulls out of the driveway. And she's a good driver.
This is coming for me.
Oh,
yeah.
oh mm-hmm. you don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want it.
I can't even imagine.
You don't want it. But then I'm like, well, what am I bringing to the table?
Mm.
Am I insecure that I let her drive too soon?
Mm-hmm.
Am I insecure that I didn't spend enough time with her in the car? And what, you know.
Is it just natural parenting?
Or is
anxiety?
It just natural that
you're not alone?
Yeah. Your kid is skyrocketing at 65 miles an hour in a tin can
yep.
with a license plate on it. And you know, you yeah. should be a little nervous.
See, the capacity to ask yourself that question means you're a good parent, right? Because it's the parents who have no self-awareness
right.
that kind of spritz out at their kids.
Right.
Yeah.
But your question, mm-hmm. you got to develop a whole theorem. You got to develop the Greenwood theorem of every interaction, every decision should begin with, what am I bringing
mm-hmm.
to the table?
Mm-hmm.
And then choose your path from there.
Yeah, how am I navigating my environment, right? Because
right.
there's also like what is around me and
well, you can,
yeah.
you can go to that after.
Yeah.
But the first thing should be your
yeah.
question:
how to locate yourself.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
yeah.
Will you come back?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah, awesome. Super fun.
I would keep going, but I have an 11:30.
Oh, no. That it, great.
I didn't know you were going to be this cool.
It's good to be underestimated. That's
there you
good.
Go. Yeah. No, no, I just thought, Professor, we're going to go through the social stuff. And then I'm like, oh, wait a second. She has a personality. This is a three-hour show. This is not an hour and a half-hour show.
Super fun talking.
Will you come back, though?
Absolutely.
Because these are my questions that I didn't ask you.
Ah, yet. Amazing.
I didn't get to the book yet. So
okay, which book?
This book.
Oh, that book.
Not your book. This book. Well, I didn't get to your book yet because you didn't write it.
That's right. Great. I would love to come back. Okay, very stimulating.
Fantastic. And thank you for being funny too. You're really funny.
Oh, I try.
it works. It's the interesting comedy.
Oh, good.
Is there anything you want me to push or sell or anything you want people to pay attention to?
Oh my
anything?
God, I wasn't prepared for this question. I don't know. Push or sell kindness.
Well done.
Let's do that. Let's be kind to each other and focus on other people, and not to the exclusion of your own self, but be connected.
Beautiful. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Good?
Yeah.
Yeah.